The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to Mark Voger, the author of Monster Mash, The Creepy, Kooky Monster Craze in America, 1957 to 1972. It is a wow of an illustrated piece of pop American culture with a flowing narrative that fills in a lot of details and trivia. Stick around. This is bound to be a graveyard smash. So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, brought to you today by Amazon.com. When you visit MrMedia.com and click on any of the links to purchase books, music, movies, gift certificates, or anything else through our Amazon link, you support this free video podcast. Whenever you need something else from Amazon, please consider returning to MrMedia.com to order it. It doesn't cost you any extra, and we sure appreciate the support. And don't forget, MrMedia.com has more than 1,200 celebrity audio and video interviews archived on the site. That's hundreds upon hundreds of hours free entertainment. Subscribe for free on MrMedia.com, and you'll instantly get an email every time a new interview is posted. You can also watch and subscribe to the show on YouTube, Vimeo, Dailymotion, The Realm Network, and Frequency.com. And if you prefer to just listen, Mr. Media is also available for free on iTunes, Spreaker, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Blueberry, TuneIn, Blog Talk Radio, Podfeed.net, and Player FM. You can subscribe to any of those services and never miss another episode. Finally, you can interact with Mr. Media Interviews on all kinds of social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and more. Friend or follow us, we'll friend or follow you back. Thanks for listening. Thanks for watching. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience full of werewolves, zombies, vampires, and other assorted neighbors of mine in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. 1957. That must have been a hell of a year to be alive. Well, I mean, I wouldn't know. My birth was still a few years off. But coming on the heels of the comic book industry nearly being wiped out by Frederick Wortham's book, Seduction of the Innocent, and the subsequent Kefauver hearings in the U.S. Senate, a few in the media still dared to challenge the country to consume something more than pablum in 1957. Monsters! After lying low for several communist witch hunt years, movie monsters made a big comeback in 1957. I Was a Teenage Werewolf with Michael Landon was first, followed by Curse of Frankenstein the very next week. Not even TV was safe, as Screen Gems rolled out its shock package of 52 Universal horror films to independent and hard-to-find UHF stations. And if you don't know what a UHF station is, go ask your parents. As Mark Voger writes in his new book, Monster Mash, The Creepy, Kooky Monster Craze in America, 1957 to 1972, 1957 was the nail in the coffin for genre naysayers. Taboos were being broken. The stake had been removed. This is a sensational book for its illustrated trip down memory lane, aimed at the generations of us who grew up watching late-night movie hosts such as Zachary, listening to Bobby Pickett sing Monster Mash, building and painting Frankenstein monster scale models, convincing Mom to let us watch the monsters, collecting and trading Tops ugly stickers, and boy were they ugly, and reading famous monsters of Filmland magazine, or my personal favorite, The Monster Times. Now, this summer has even echoed those long-gone days. Have you heard Fall Out Boy's hit single Uma Thurman? Over and over it repeats the guitar riff from the Monsters theme song. And with that, Mark Voger, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you, Bob. It's great to be here, and from your lips to God's ears.
I think that's how it works. Or, as they would say on The Office, that's what she said. Now, I knew I would love this book when I first heard about it, Mark, and getting it in my hands was no disappointment. But how did you decide to pursue this particular topic?
Well, Bob, I mean, it's a labor of love. It's I think it's the book I was meant to do. It's my third, but it's really me working on the whole project. I really researched it, you know, all my life. The first interview I did for it was in the late 80s. When I started the book proper, it was 14 months, but it really did feel like a lifetime. And I honestly think that my inner 8-year-old is the guy who wrote this book.
He would have if he could have, right?
Yeah, I made sure that that he would be happy. You know, I brought this as a little bit of comfort. It's a Frankenstein Silky from 1963, a bubble bath toy.
Wow.
And my mom wouldn't buy it for me in '63, so I bought it for only $45 about 15 years ago.
And who's your other friend?
Oh, I brought the Wolfman and I brought the Mummy also. You probably know Bob. I only need one more, the Creature. But he's very expensive. Like he's like a buck and a quarter. It might be a few years before I get my Creature. You know?
Oh, come on! You've got a high paying newspaper job, don't you?
I have a high paying newspaper job, and also I have job security. I have, you know, I'm set.
Yeah.
I'm set
in the newspaper industry.
Yeah.
I did my part. I subscribed to that newspaper in the 70s, so I've done all I can do for you.
Bob is talking about the Star Ledger, where I slapped together pages for the Star Ledger, and once in a while I write for the Star Ledger still.
There you go. So yeah. What was your – and I should point out that we're both born and bred Jersey boys.
Represent.
Yes, and I think that's part of why this meant a lot to me to read and talk to you is that I think we have that commonality of the experiences and the things that we were exposed to, and probably the things that our parents wouldn't buy us when we were young kids.
It's weird because I know I have a lot of friends, like actual dear friends, who were into this stuff back then, and they still are now. One is a film critic, one is an art director for newspapers, one is a novelist, one is an actor, a very accomplished actor. And I just heard from a gentleman named Greg Nicotero, who's a director and zombie designer on The Walking Dead. And he's a little younger than you, I think, Bob, and he loved this stuff. And it almost seems like you're in the media, you are Mr. Media. It almost seems that a lot of the guys that loved this stuff back then somehow eked out careers for themselves. It's strange.
It's a lot of work just to be able to get to afford some of these toys.
Oh, yeah. Well, the Mummy, I don't even want to tell you what I paid for the Mummy, but I just look at it as an investment. I could probably turn it around on eBay and get another $15 for it like that.
Oh, just like that, huh?
Yeah.
So tell us a little more, though, about your personal connection to the material. What were you interested in you were too young in the 50s yet, but in the 60s, what was the stuff that you remembered or that caught your eye and that stayed with you?
Well, it probably was the Frankenstein Silky first. I was born in 58, so by the time I started becoming aware of the world around me, monsters were already there, and they were confusing to me. I didn't understand that that reaction of simultaneous attraction and repulsion, you know, because you'd see a monster face and it would scare you. You know, some of those FM covers are still frightening, I think. But at the same time, you it was like a rush and you wanted more. So I'm a Catholic school boy, and that really confused me even further because like the nuns and the priests were always beating it into us, literally beating it with rulers, you know.
Yeah. They're
saying
monsters.
That yeah. But they're saying that, we're the one true church. You know, everybody else is wrong. We're right. Then I would see a Dracula movie and Peter Cushing would whip out a crucifix and they'd have a close up of it. They'd play church music. They'd have a light on it. Dracula would recoil in horror. And I just thought as a 6-year-old, oh, I guess the nuns are right. I guess, you know, we're the one true church because you can't stop Dracula with a gun, but you whip out a crucifix. He's toast.
Now, when was the point when you realized there was a connection, and I'm guessing this is as an adult, between what went on in the 50s, Frederick Wortham and Kefauver and the comic book companies all pulling back, the movie studios pulling back, that connection to the communist witch hunts, all that kind of stuff. When do you make that connection?
Well, much like yourself, Bob, I did also become a comic book fanatic, a fan. And then, I mean, even as a young adult, I hadn't learned everybody's names. I wasn't, like, so savvy. I rediscovered them as an adult, and then all of a sudden I'm like, wow, you know, Jack Kirby and, you know, Kurt Schaffenberger and Ross Vandrew is a big favorite of mine, Kurt Swan, you know, Steve Ditko. I would easily, you know, not only identify their styles, but you can also kind of tell what decade they drew it in if you're a real aficionado. And then I found out about The Witch Hunt. You mentioned Kefauver. I recently watched a Betty Page documentary, and he tried to stop her too. So it's just like, wow, this guy who almost became vice president, like, tried to stop Betty Page and comic and horror comics and EC comics. So, you know, what a guy.
And
he was
a Democrat, as I recall.
Yeah. Well, such was, the social paranoia that was going on in the 1950s. There was just so much of, you know, you're either one of us or you're one of them, you know. And I think that rock and roll and the monster craze were two things that were these organic things, like these kind of accidental revolutions that happened. And, an 8-year-old kid who, I mean, isn't worried about politics, isn't worried about being afraid of, you know, being seen as an other. He just sees Frankenstein and says, wow, that's cool, you know.
Well, it was this time young people challenging all the conventions and the establishment. And we had words we couldn't spell, like anyway.
I just say supercalifragilistic.
There you go. That's the word. But it turns out that the monsters weren't Frankenstein, and the monsters were real people. I mean, they were the ones who caused people who believed in freedom and democracy to be afraid at night. Those were the real monsters of that era, weren't they?
Absolutely. And and then even going back, like I own a book that called No Traveler Returns. It's about Bela Lugosi's lost years, and I hadn't known this, but they make a great case that that conventional monsters like Frankenstein, who was last seen in 1948 in Abbott Costello Meets Frankenstein, and then not seen again for many years, they were kind of marginalized because the Nazi atrocities were in the newsreels. So people were seeing them, you know, pre-television. They were seeing them on the big screen before their movies, and that was one of the things that, you know, how could monsters be scary anymore when the monsters of real life are so much more terrible?
I hadn't thought about it that way, but that makes a great point. That takes it back a whole other generation, the explanation of it. Let's get into the meat of the book. The art in this book is spectacular. I mean, I just, every time I turned the page, I was like, wow, this is cool. I remember this. But what I wondered is, did you struggle to find the art, or was there so much art you were forced to choose between what to keep in and what to keep out?
Well, Bob, a little of both. There were a lot of the photos, 80 photos of the book, were taken by my late wife, Kathy Vogelsong. We were a writer-photographer team, and our first assignment was our honeymoon, and we did a travel story out of it. And so we always covered the convention scene. We went to the Fango conventions, comical conventions, anything. And we would always go early and just cruise the vendors, and I'd say, oh, cool, a Wolfman Silky. Can we take a picture of it? So a lot of those pictures, a lot of those photos of the memorabilia we've been shooting them for 20 years. But right up to the end, there was things I wanted that I couldn't get. And I'll just show you one example. I have it here. There was an Uncle Fester puppet from 1964. Here he is right here. Yeah. This is my favorite page in the book.
Really?
Yeah, because it's one full page of just like an extreme close-up of the Uncle Fester puppet. What happened was, towards
so
the end...
So ugly, too.
Yeah. Towards the end, I suddenly remembered, oh, Mark Lavecchio in fourth grade had this great Uncle Fester puppet. I got to get it in the book. And that one, I'll tell you, I paid $85 for it, but I wanted him in the book. So it was like a combination. You know, there's a couple of toys that I've like, ooh, you know, I didn't get it in, but for the most part, I'm pleased. I think I touched on everything.
Did you track down Mark to get it, or did you find it some other way?
Oh no, I got it through eBay, and it was even better than I remember, because I just remember being cool, but then when I looked at it as an adult, I was like, his facial expression is really hard to describe. It's almost like he's pleased with something very horrible that just happened.
It's interesting. Yeah, I remember like the there's that one very famous Frankenstein scale model. Did I write it down here?
You talking about Big Frankie?
I'm not sure, I think you have a picture of it in the book. And I remember,
oh, the Aurora Frankenstein one?
Aurora Frankenstein.
Sure.
Right. Yeah. So I remember my next-door neighbor having it. And he and I didn't have a whole lot in common, but I remember he had an older brother, which I did not. And I don't know if he or his older brother made and painted that model. But, boy, I wanted that for years. And that was something my parents would never buy me. But we also traded – and this was the other thing I loved in the book – the ugly stickers. And it's again, this thing's come down to you and your friends in the 60s. But seeing as an adult, discovering that someone named Basil Wolverton had done, I think, a dozen, 14 of those, and then Wally Wood did them, and then there was another fellow who is not as prominent, who is credited with a lot of them. But we bought and sold and traded those things. Those were, to me, that. Seeing those in this book, seeing so many of those reprinted in the book, that was the key thing I loved about this book, was just capturing that moment in time for me.
Thank you, Bob. Well, one of the things that we, a lot of us, you know, adults that are looking back on this stuff, we always kind of refer to it as like porn. Like when we got an issue of Famous Monsters of Filmland, the first thing we did was just like page by page go through it, and we'd be like, oh, look at that, oh, look at that. And then later in life, we're like, that was porn for us. And same thing with the ugly stickers. You know, when you opened a pack of those things, the first thing you did was you just wanted, there's probably five in the pack, you just looked at them, and you know, that's the same effect I'm trying to get, is bring that back. Yeah. And I designed the book also, so I had like complete control over that flow and that look.
And then, of course, we graduated to Vampirella. And,
Vampirella was much more fun to look at than Uncle Creepy and Cousin Eerie.
Yeah, once you realize that you're interested we didn't call it porn at the time, we were too young, but once you realize that you were more interested in those images, then I would take a pack of those ugly stickers any day now. I still find myself in, there's certain like, you know, the old shops where you would get Topps baseball cards or the ugly stickers. There's certain smells that will take you back immediately, and I think, boy, I wonder if they have those. Oh no, it's been 30, 40 years. They don't have ugly stickers anymore. They're gone.
It's funny you mentioned Vampirella, because when she debuted in '69, I was 11, so I was like, perfect. It was like, thank you God for Vampirella. You know.
Yeah. Well, tell me about some of your other favorite things that you found in the book, or people that you talked to.
Well, that again was also something that I was always working on it, and I remember thinking like things like, I gotta get Bobby Boris Pickett on the phone, and I gotta get James Bama, who painted all the Aurora box art. I gotta get him on the phone. He's still alive, you know, and he's still alive. But Bobby Boris Pickett left us, so I would just go after everybody. I wrote about. I hate to use the word wrote, past tense, but I'll say I write about pop culture for all those years. I was at the Asbury Park Press for 26 years, and then the Star Ledger for 6 years before we just did a reorganization. So I would always go after somebody from the Brady Bunch or the Partridge Family or somebody in 10 Years After, or, you know, the Beatles, you know, like I just, anything retro pop culture, I just went after them. And so I have like a lot of interviews, and in the book I always tell you what year if I, you know, it's a Pat Priest interview, I tell you what year it was done, so that you just have, like, the interviews are timeless. You know, we're only talking about stuff that happened in 1964, you know, whatever. But I just wanted you to kind of know. But that, but yeah, that's what I did. The people I talked to were just, they were just all wonderful, and it was for everyone. I'm like, Grandpa Munster was awesome because. Yeah, Al Lewis. Because the weird thing about him,
everything about Al was weird.
The non-weird thing about Al Lewis, but I you know, knew that he was at his restaurant, Grandpa's Bellagente, in the Village in New York City. So I went there one day, and he sat down at our table, gave us an interview, posed for pictures, smoked these smelly stogies. And his nails were really long. That was another weird thing. But the weird thing about talking to him is it was like talking to Grandpa Munster. There was no difference. He would berate you. He would say, "Good gracious me!" Like, it just, you know. So Al and Grandpa were, I think, one and the same, except for Al didn't sleep in a coffin.
You think?
Until.
I mean, and he became a part of the on and off over the years of the Howard Stern Show, of all things. He was, you know, he popped up there. He became on his own as Grandpa Munster, you know, in New York at the restaurant, right? I mean, he had this whole life that went on beyond the TV show.
He ran for mayor of New York City. I mean, and he was serious about it. He was a character, a one of a kind. The world shall never see his like again, Bob.
And he embraced it, whereas someone like Fred Gwynne, who played Herman Munster, just hated it, as I understood. He wanted nothing to do with it when it was over. He was a real actor, at least he was until he played Fred Munster. I mean, Herman Munster. Terrible.
Yeah,
and I'm confused.
Yeah, you see him in, like, On the Waterfront and things like that. Al embraced it. Al had a ball with it, you know. He just and his logo for Grandpa's Bellagente was a caricature done by Fred Gwynne, who is a great caricaturist and artist. You know, Fred Gwynne was a Pat Priest who played Marilyn Munster called Fred Gwynne a Renaissance man.
Really. Well, I want to mention some of the other people that you interview in here. Speaking of the Munsters, of course, you have Butch Patrick and Al Lewis. You have Pat Priest. You had an interview. You had multiple interviews with John Astin from the Addams Family that are kind of culled, and you put them together. You talked to Lisa Loring from the Addams Family. Zachary, who I remember very well from the UHF channels and the Shock Theater and such. You also talked to a lot of the magazine people and the publishers, Russ Jones and Jim Warren, who I've interviewed at great length, and Forry Ackerman. Who is the best get for you? Who are you most excited to get to talk to over the years?
Probably is Grandpa Munster, but I mean. But like I said, everybody made their contribution, and if I hadn't have gotten Forry Ackerman or Jim Warren, that would be a hole, you know. I mean, if I didn't talk to somebody, for instance, I didn't talk to, is it Dan Campbell who did the Weirdos art? I didn't speak to Dan Campbell, so I quoted from oldmodelkids.com, identified as such, you know. So, Forry Ackerman was great. I mean, Uncle Forry, he was there when we grew up. He provided so many wonderful childhood memories. One of the things that I found out from talking to Jim Warren and Forry Ackerman when I talked to them together, I always assumed that Jim Warren was the guy who sat in the office, you know, and that Forry Ackerman put the book together. And then both of them told me that that Jim did the layout. Jim was like the unnamed art director of Famous Monsters. He created that logo. He did his first painted cover with issue number 3. He developed the two-leg, two-column layout system, all that creepy original, the headline type that they would do that was specific to each story. So he was, and he was the guy who hired Basil Gogos or Maurice Whitman or Ron Cobb to do all those, you know, those amazing covers. So, and Forry says, yeah, no, I had nothing to do with picking the covers. I would write stories. I would revise stories. So he was strictly an editor, and the two of them were quite a combination.
The covers, I was never a big fan of the magazine, Famous Monsters of Filmland, but the covers, you had to look at the cover. They stood out. They were always excellent. And we for people who don't know Famous Monsters of Filmland, but might know that Jim Warren also published Eerie and Creepy and Vampirella and the Spirit magazine for a year or two or three. I don't remember how long that was. I guess I should. All right, so a couple more things here before we let you go. Two words. I want your reaction to one of the monsters in your book that you have a short interview with, Bill Cosby.
Oh, well, of course there is horrible baggage now that just comes with the mention of his name. It makes me very sad. There's so much evidence. A man is innocent until proven guilty. I mean, there's so much testimony.
Incredible irony, though, that you have Bill Cosby in this magazine, in this book about monsters at this moment in time, though, isn't it?
Yeah, the timing was awful. I mean, and who knows? You know, like I said, I'm heartbroken. He was a hero. I don't know if I can say he is a hero. I don't want to try him, you know, here.
But why is he? Tell people why he's in the book.
He's in the book because I have a section on Boris Karloff, probably the greatest monster star. You know, I would say even a greater monster star than Lon Senior, because Lon Senior wasn't thinking monster. Karloff was actually playing monsters, you know. Karloff, you know, worked right up until the end, and he was on The Girl from U.N.C.L.E. So I have a section where I have the Girl from U.N.C.L.E. and he was on I Spy. So I have quotes from Bill Cosby remembering Karloff working with him on I Spy.
It's a great story too. I mean, I got to give Cosby credit. He tells a great story about being in the back seat of a car with he's in the back and Robert Culp and Boris Karloff are in the front seat. And he's scared, still, as a grown man, he's still scared of Boris Karloff.
And that was if you ever see that episode, it was shot in Spain. I think it's called the Rain on the Plane or something. And Karloff plays a man who thinks he's Don Quixote. And he is sword fighting, and he's, you know, he's fighting and railing, and he's very energetic, and he looks very brittle. And so he was that kind of guy. He just worked till the end, and he wanted to die with his grease paint on, and he did it.
All right, so two more words. I want you to explain to people why these words are in your book. Black Sabbath.
Well, it goes back to Boris Karloff again. Black Sabbath, of course, is a heavy metal band, or proto-metalists. They were really just a very heavy, like Cream on Downs, blues band from Birmingham, England. And they named their band after a Boris Karloff film, Mario Bava's 1964 Italian film, Black Sabbath. And Ozzy Osbourne, the lead singer, told me that. So did Tony Iommi, the guitar player. So I have it from excellent authority that they named their band after a Boris Karloff movie.
And how appropriate that years later, Ozzy becomes well known for biting the head off a bat. Perfect symmetry, right?
Yeah. And Karloff came close to biting the head off a bat in Black Sabbath. It was the only film in which he played a vampire. So he never played a werewolf. He played Mummy, Frankenstein, and even a vampire right when he was in his late 70s in Black Sabbath.
All right. Kind of the last thing here is for young people who were born after this period, are there maybe a handful of monster movies that maybe they might have overlooked or that you would send them to go check out to kind of give them a sense of this period?
Well, I would point to the Universal classics, Frankenstein, Dracula, the Wolfman. Frankenstein meets the Wolfman is really cool. And the ones where they had all three monsters, House of Frankenstein, House of Dracula. My favorite movie of all time, I mean, counting Citizen Kane, counting The Godfather, is Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, you know. But I would also want to make sure that they saw the Ed Wood movies. I'd want to make sure they saw, you know, Bride of the Monster and Plan 9 from Outer Space. And I'd want to make sure they saw the really cool, cheesy American International movies of the 50s, like Ghost of Dragstrip Hollow and Invasion of the Saucer Men. So I'd try to, you know, make it eclectic.
Yeah, very good. All right, so what's next for you?
Well, the next thing I'm going to do, Bob, is I'm going to go back out there into the newsroom where they're all cursing my name, and I'm going to slap the food together, the food page together for the Trenton Times.
Ah, okay. All right. So not another book project at the moment?
Oh, I have some pitches. I have some pitches out, but, you know, I'm Irish and superstitious, you know, but, please visit markvoger.com. I'm always, updating it and putting blogs and, reviewing, you know, old movies. That's where I'm trying to keep my writing thing going. So probably the next cool thing I'm going to do is my next post for the website.
All right. Well, folks, listen, you can find Mark Voger's brightly illustrated new book, Monster Mash, The Creepy, Kooky Monster Craze in America, 1957 to 1972. He's holding it up there.
Yeah, baby.
In great stores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. If you're watching on MrMedia.com, you know how this works. Somewhere below the video, you'll see the cover of the book. Click on it right now. It'll take you to Amazon, and they can get it to you via drone in 30 minutes or less. At least that's what I hear. I also know that if you go to tomorrows.com, and that's tworomorrows.com, you can probably order it as a PDF and look at it on your computer. So you mentioned Mark Voger, V-O-G-E-R.com is a website. Are you on social media, Twitter, Facebook, things like that?
No, Bob, I'm not. I'm pretty behind the times. I'm going to show you my phone. There's my phone.
Yep.
So, you know, I'm not on the Facebook, but one of these days, but
you'll get around to it.
All yeah. Right.
Well, Mark Voger, fun book, fun conversation, and thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Bob, thank you very much for having me. I very much appreciate it, and I had a blast.
Turn up the stereo receiver.